Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1954 that racial desegregation in public schools was unconstitutional. Some school districts were not swayed by Brown versus the Board of Education and found ways to discriminate. Mexican-American students in Driscoll, Texas, were purposely held back to avoid retarding the white students. Students with Spanish surnames were made to take first grade for 3 years. It didn't matter how fluent they were in English or if all they knew was English. As a result, they were graduating from high school in their early 20s. A group of 8 elementary school students went to court in 1957 and sued Driscoll Consolidated Independent School District. The suit was filed on their behalf by the American GI Forum, a group founded to battle discrimination against Hispanic veterans. Enrique Alemán is a professor and chair in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Alemán's mother turned out to be one of those children. She mentioned it in passing to him once, but never made the connection.
At that point, she told me, I was 20 years old, almost 21 years old when I graduated from high school. And so I was like, well, why is it that you graduated from high school that late? Did you fail? Were you not good in school? And I just remember her telling her, no, what they used to do when I was in elementary school was they would put us in first grade for several years. And I was involved with a court case as a little child to change that system. And that was really the only time that she ever mentioned it. She passed away in 2002.
Alemán joins us on Fronteras to tell us why he needed to find the 7 surviving students and document what he found on film.
Before the film, I was doing oral histories with folks that were from that town and part of the case and collecting their stories for a research project that I was doing. And in one case, one of the actual students that testified talked about her experience of literally being taken to the white kids' classroom to read to them because she was such a great reader that she was actually a good model for them to use. So she had to go into their classroom and read a book and show to them how to do it and then go back into her segregated classroom. So, yeah, there was never any type of test evaluation done on these children. It was just a way, if you had a Spanish surname, you were automatically put into these 3 levels of first grade, and you really had no way of getting out of that until you got into second grade after your 3 years.
And so during this case that was being tried in court, there were 8 children who were taken to actually testify, mm-hmm. which was kind of unheard of at the time. And your personal connection to the case comes in there. So can you tell us about that connection to the case and why it took you so long to find out about it?
Yeah, this is the part that really inspired me to go find out more about the case and to want to do a project to really tell that part of our history that hadn't been told, because it's part of my own personal family history. It wasn't until the early 2000s when I was in my doctoral program at UT Austin. My mother had been struggling with cancer for several years and in the late 90s, and then in the 2000s, it came back pretty strong, and she ended up passing away when I was in my doctoral program. And it was about a month after we buried her, I saw a documentary about Dr. Hector P. Garcia and the American GI Forum, where they talk about this small little town of Driscoll, which I immediately knew that's where my mother was born, that's where she was raised, and that's where we had literally just buried her, in the Mexican cemetery in Driscoll. And I had a flashback to one time when I was a kid where she told me about being part of a court case. And I knew I needed to find out as much about that case. I couldn't sleep that night. I ended up finding out that all the documents, all the archives for that case from the federal courthouse in Corpus had been stored in Fort Worth. And so as soon as I could, I made a trip up to Fort Worth from Austin and was able to go through the legal documents and read for the first time that she was one of the students. And she was actually the first of the 8 students to testify in federal court against her teachers in the district to prove that she could speak English as a 9-year-old second grader, almost 10 years old. That blew me away. I didn't understand how growing up in South Texas, going through a doctoral program in educational policy, I had never even known about this case. And so that's what got me to start asking more questions. And I really wanted to understand, what was it about that time period? What was it about my mother's experience that she never talked about it? What was it about my own educational background and my own educational preparation and training that I never even knew about this case? And it prompted me to go and start asking more questions and to try to find eight children. Like you said, eight children testified. My mother was one of them. I didn't know where the other seven were. And I didn't know if any of the parents were alive. And so it started the ball rolling with the goal of, at some point, trying to reclaim that part of my history that had been lost for so long.
Is that what inspired the film Stolen Education?
It did inspire it. I was very fortunate to get a Ford Foundation postdoctoral fellowship through the Ford Foundation, which allowed me about a year off from my, I was at the University of Utah at the time as a professor, and it gave me the ability to travel back and forth to find the people that I needed to find and to collect those oral histories. In the process of collecting those oral histories and learning more about that history, I met Rudy Luna, who's my co-writer and co-producer on this film, who's done a few independent films, but never done a documentary and wasn't an educational researcher. And so we started talking and we said, let's do a documentary about this.
So not only did you not know about the case, but you also talked to, I think, one of the board of trustees at Driscoll, who also really wasn't that familiar with the case. And then you also, I remember you were talking to Norma Cantu of Trinity University about the case and how not that many people know about it. And she seemed shocked because she says this is a case that changed education. It's almost like a public service because, again, there's just so much of Texas history that is being untold, that is not being shared with people who need to know that history really can't be repeating itself mm-hmm. again and again.
I'm born and raised in Kingsville. You know, I think having gone through public schools in Texas and understanding Texas, you have to learn Texas history. And my history was never part of that. I think that you're right. We've done a really good job in our public school system of erasing multiple histories, not just the Mexican-American history, but also women's history, African-American history, Native American history. It's very much tied to the conversation that we're currently having about having Mexican-American studies, ethnic studies back in the schools in K-12. I think it's extremely important for the population that we serve that we tell a fuller, more comprehensive, more critical understandings of history. And it's part of what I think should be part of the standard curriculum in Texas. And, you know, there's been activists, there's been educators that have and leaders that have been fighting for this in Texas for the longest time. And we're finally starting to get some traction because of the activism and because of the leadership that we've had. But this is part of it. This is an example that literally in my own home, and I have a doctorate in educational policy, literally in my own home, I never knew about this until I had that flashback and I saw that one little documentary about Dr. Garcia that mentioned Driscoll. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known. And at the end of the day, I wanted to make, for those that are still alive, I wanted to acknowledge and validate their experiences and really do justice to their story. And there's so many stories out there. This is just one story that was erased for so long. And so the point, I think, is to encourage our, you know, multiple communities that we have to tell those stories that are still there.
Enrique Alemán is a professor and chair in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's also the executive producer and co-writer of the documentary Stolen Education. When we come back, the plaintiffs who testified as children in the Driscoll case still feel the anguish today.
But the fact that she was put into these three levels of first grade and had to read the same books every single year and then literally had to be taken to a white classroom to show them how to read, that stuck with her as a 7-8-year-old and now as a 70-year-old.
More with Enrique Alemán is next on Fronteras.
Support for this podcast comes from Sunshine Cottage's Noche del Sol, a fiesta kickoff event with Mexican food, entertainment, and Delaritas, plus a raffle and auctions to benefit the school for deaf children, March 26th, 6 p.m. More at sunshinecottage.org.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Spanish surnamed children who attended public schools in Driscoll, Texas in the 1950s were placed into first grade for 3 years. There was no proficiency test. Some students only knew English and had to take 3 years of first grade anyway. The district was accused of discrimination against Mexican-American students and taken to court in 1957. 8 children were called to testify against Driscoll CISD. One child was Enrique Alemán's mother. Alemán is a professor and chair in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He didn't know the details of his mother's involvement in the case until after her death in 2002. Alemán decided he needed to track down the 7 surviving students. He documented his journey in the film Stolen Education.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to find out of the 7 that are still alive, that everybody talked to me. Not everybody wanted to do it on camera. I didn't realize I'm asking them to remember a traumatic part of their own experience. And so the fact that I'm asking them to do it on camera, there's a couple of them, 2 of them that didn't want to do it on camera, but everybody else did share what they went through. And it's things like Connie was one of the ones that I mentioned that was brought into the white classroom to show them the proper way of reading, and then having to go back into her classroom and be humiliated that way. None of them went to their high school reunions over the years just because of the bad experiences that they had. They talk about being humiliated in different ways, from having tape put over their mouth for speaking Spanish in the playground, or, you know, being 19 or 20 years old, you know, in high school.
There was something wrong. That why was I older than everybody else? Were they conscious of what they were doing? You know, as adults, I certainly think so.
These are all 70-year-old individuals that have lived a lifetime and having experiences as young children, and it's still very fresh in their minds. Again, it contextualizes mid-1950s South Texas and what was going on. The other thing that's pretty fascinating for me, too, is like what was happening across the South with the bus boycotts and the civil rights movement across the South. This was happening at the same time. And when I showed the film at Clemson University, which is in South Carolina, there was a predominant African-American population audience. And it was interesting to hear some of the African-American elders in the audience saying, you know, that was happening at the same time that we were organizing and sitting in and having our protests across the South. And I never even knew that was happening in South Texas with Mexican-American students. And so I think in another way, it's allowed me to show this story in different communities and to have conversations about racial inequity, about civil rights, in a more nuanced way, in a more holistic way that's not just black and white, which is important, but we also have to tell these other parts of our history that aren't oftentimes acknowledged.
And you mentioned a few times in the film that this is still happening, what happened back in Driscoll in the 50s. There's some element of it that's still alive right now.
For sure, because what I study on a daily basis is educational policy and how our schools continue to not provide opportunities for students of color to go all the way through higher education. If you look at all the indicators, Latinos and Latinas continue to be at the bottom of the worst indicators, you know, as far as being pushed out of school, not having access to higher ed, not having access to AP and college readiness kind of courses. So I think in a lot of ways, we're continuing to not provide opportunities or pipelines into higher ed for students of color. And in Texas, you know, the majority is Latino and Latino students. That's something that we really need to talk about when we prepare our educators and educational leaders. The second thing that it really makes me think about is language. Most educators do not look at being multilingual as an asset.
Unless you're going to a bilingual school.
Right. So, you know, I grew up in Texas and I was one of those who could understand my grandparents, but had to respond in English. I think a lot of our school policies and programs advantage those who are English dominant. We don't encourage or have not consistently encouraged being bilingual, maintaining a home language and building on that. It's been much more of a policy that is one that is trying to erase that part of, you know, who you are. And so this is an example of how Texas misses the boat on a tremendous resource, on a tremendous asset that we have built in. We have a lot of our students that have a home language that's Spanish. Why wouldn't you want to build on that? Why wouldn't you want to maintain that and strengthen that while building a second language? Everybody knows in the global economy, everybody knows in the world that we live, being bilingual or multilingual is a built-in advantage. And so for the longest time, we've had educational policy that discourages that and actually punishes people. It punishes you if you have a home language that's something other than English, rather than saying, okay, that's great. We want you to learn English, but we don't want you to lose what you have at home. It's this whole idea of two languages are greater than one. Everybody knows that, but our policy has always discouraged that part of it. This is an example. This is 60 years ago, more than 60 years ago, and I think that we have a lot of educational leaders, educational policy that continues to discourage disadvantaged students that have a home language other than English. And so I think that we need to do better at that. Actually, Texas should be leading the country in preparing bilingual, bicultural educators, engineers, medical professionals, business people. It just makes sense. El Paso, McAllen, Laredo, those should be hotbeds for like preparing students to be competitive in the global economy that way. And I think you're right. I mean, some districts are doing better at it, but we're still behind the curve on this thing. We're still behind on really taking advantage of that built-in asset.
Many of the folks that you interviewed in your film that were attending school or who had testified in the court trial, I found it interesting that most of them are still in South Texas. And there was this one woman who you interviewed, I can't remember what her name was, but she grew very emotional when she was sort of expressing regret that she wasn't able to move on with her education. If I only, that was kind of...
Connie.
As I've gotten older, you know, going to graduations, college graduations, I get this chill, even if I don't know if that person is not related, just the fact that they're graduating from college, I feel, wow, how wonderful. Had I had that opportunity, if I could turn things time back again, that would be so wonderful.
I was actually interviewing her in the actual courthouse, the courtroom where she testified. It's now a law office, and they used that same courtroom for mock trials and to prepare, I guess, for their cases. And so they allowed us to go in there, and she was remembering, you know, her experience of going into that courtroom and testifying. And so for Connie, she never was able to go to college, you know, and she felt like she wasn't able to ever achieve her dreams. Because I was asking her before, I didn't show that part of the clip, but she was talking about how she always wanted to be a nurse. That she wanted to go into the health profession. She felt she would have been a good RN, and that's kind of what she wanted to do. Even as a little kid, that's what she wanted to do. And she was never able to do that because she was one of those that graduated when she was in her 20s, early 20s. She raised a really good family. Her kids all are doing well. She had a good job. She retired. She's still very active in her community and her church. But I think in the back of her mind, it's just a question of like, what could have been? What could I have done with my life if I had had the opportunity? And the fact that Connie was, I think, the youngest of 10. So she actually went into school being fully bilingual, English and Spanish, because her brothers and sisters prepared her. Those were her first teachers. So when she showed up, she was ready to go to school. And she talks about her experience loving school and loving her teachers. But the fact that she was put into these three levels of first grade and had to read the same books every single year, and then literally had to be taken to a white classroom to show them how to read, that stuck with her as a 7-8-year-old, and now as a 70-year-old, it's this question of what could have been and what could I have made of myself.
What about the other individuals who testified? What became of their lives?
I mean, everybody did well. Two of them went to college. One of them became a teacher for over 30 years, and I think some of the teachers at Driscoll inspired her to do that. But everybody else, you know, that served in the military, had really good working class jobs, raised families. But you're right, most of them stuck around South Texas. That's why it was easy for me to find them. And I was also very fortunate. My dad, who was married to my mom for 33 years, still lives in the community and knew quite a few of these people. And
there were a few Alemans I noticed in the film.
Yeah, and it's kind of confusing sometimes because my dad's Aleman and my mom's Aleman. Oh. So this is my mom's side of the family. And they're not related or anything. We did the genealogy, but my grandfather did it. My dad's from the Valley, which is another 2 hours south of there. But it's a small little town, so I was related to quite a few people in this. And that was the other interesting part of the project was I was talking to folks that either met me as a little baby. I had never had an adult interaction with them, so I was going back and learning from them and learning about my own family history and talking to people who knew my mother at different parts of her life. So that was the other part that makes it bigger for me as far as a research project, because I was hearing about my mother's life as a 7 and 8 year old, about what it was like to know her in high school, about what how she was as a young adult, as a young mother. And so for me, it's been kind of a personal journey of learning about my own family history, but also trying to understand what it was like to grow up in 1950s and 60s South Texas, at a time when our country was going through a lot of changes, and trying to reclaim that part of our history as valid and as something that we should really celebrate.
Enrique Alemán is the executive producer and co-writer of the documentary Stolen Education. He's also a professor and chair in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. The U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Texas Corpus Christi Division ordered an end to the practice of beginner's first, low first, and middle first grade for Spanish surnamed students in the Driscoll CISD. The decision prohibited segregation of Hispanic students in public schools. Stolen Education is available for rent or purchase on Amazon. Amazon Prime members can watch it for free. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. And our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.